Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's made a pact with the devil. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my horn department propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey. Don't know how to take that.
Probably best not to ask. So, in this episode, we're doing another book club episode. We're talking about Joshua Greene's book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the storming of the presidency. It's not quite being made clear who exactly is the devil who is being bargained with or bargained for in that scenario.
No, it's not made clear whether or not it's Steve Bannon who's doing a deal with the devil, Trump, or Trump who is doing the deal with the devil, Bannon.
In fact, it feels like it's newly relevant, what with Michael Wolff's book that's come out this week, in which Steve Bannon is quoted for saying that Trump Jr.'s meeting with Russians in Trump Tower with Paul Manafort was evil, treasonous and wrong, which is interesting. Evil, treasonous and wrong, by the way, also the name of Jacob Rees-Mogg's cats. In this episode, we're going to be talking about Breitbart and bullshit, nationalism and narrative, and did World of Warcraft propel Donald Trump to the presidency? As true history graduate, Steve, can we start by talking about what's not in the book? Steve Bannon's time in the White House.
Yes.
So, because the idea of the book, so Joshua Greene, he works for The Atlantic, he's a reporter at Bloomberg Business Week. It's a book that's obviously a bit like Michael Wolff's one. It's based on access. The start of the book is Steve Bannon phoning Joshua Greene after he's left the White House in disgrace. In ignominy, however
which,
you want to call it.
Which, if you believe Donald Trump, he was in fact in tears as he was fired.
The idea is that essentially Steve Bannon is this kind of great manipulator, this thinker who ran Trump's campaign and was a factor in Trump winning. Now, maybe I'm owing a little bit to Tommy Vietor ranting on Pod Save America, but that seems a little bit overblown. So it ignores the fact that Bannon's time in the White House, he was a pretty rubbish political operator. The thing that he tried to run, got Trump to do at the start of the presidency was the Muslim ban, which was a badly crafted piece of rubbish that was overturned by the courts because it was so incoherently done. Trump didn't take up Bannon's infrastructure stuff. In fact, they had Infrastructure Week, which I'm guessing is not a way you market a policy.
No.
That kind of failed because I think that was the week in which Trump said that he fired Comey because of the Russia thing. Also, the fact that Steve Bannon then backed Roy Moore for Senate, that is not the hallmark of a great political operator. Also, Bannon isn't the reason Trump won. In fact, he's definitely not in the top five reasons Trump won the election. He might just about be in the top 10. Do you think the book overplays the influence he had over Trump and the campaign?
I think the book overplays his role in terms of the day-to-day management or actually crafting the campaign. I think the book does get some things right, though, in terms of Bannon's influence to creating the context in which it became possible for Trump to win, though. So one of the things that the book does show is kind of Bannon's role in the kind of seedy underbelly of the Republican Party, which is where all the Clinton conspiracy nuts reside. These are the people who think that Bill and Hillary murdered or were responsible for the murder of an aide of theirs. These are the people who are still banging on about the Uranium One deal. Hillary Clinton committed treason by selling uranium to a foreign country, even though it's been proven to be complete bullshit.
And these are the people who go to pizza parlours assuming there's an underground den in which they kill people.
Exactly. They are the sorts of people who were running absolutely rampant in the 1990s Republican Party under Newt Gingrich as the Speaker of the House, who just completely went OTT with their conspiracy theories and their attacks on the Clintons when it eventually cost them Congress. What Bannon has been able to do, though, before getting involved with Trump directly, was build out the Breitbart network. And through his relationships with Roger Ailes, the founder of Fox News, was able to shift kind of like the right-wing narrative in a direction which benefits Donald Trump and his campaign quite effectively. So whilst the notion of Steve Bannon as master political operative, shadowy figure who's able to manipulate people into doing what he wants is massively overblown. Steve Bannon as media mogul, who's able to tap into a reserve of kind of like right-wing anger, that's very real. And I think the success of Breitbart just proved all the proof you need of that.
The interesting thing with Bannon in that kind of Breitbart world is that you've got two different ways of attacking Clinton, I think, essentially.
Yeah.
And one of them is that, as you say, what Bannon seems to have wanted to try and do is move away from the conspiracy nut jobs and just focus on facts, reported facts in established news outlets and other research tanks, and establish proper research operations with proper researchers to look into stuff like, say, the Clinton Foundation, where there is legitimately dodgy stuff going on. And so you've got that on the one hand. On the other hand, you have Breitbart, which is a bullshit-producing machine. And the way that Bannon is quoted describing it in the book is that Breitbart doesn't necessarily concern itself with factual truth. It concerns itself with narrative truth. And actually, I found that a very interesting way of looking at the bullshit industry, that a lot of the fake news sites like Breitbart, places like the Canary and Squawk Box as well, the way in which they see the world, actually, it is kind of very narrative driven. The idea is that it's all about stories with goodies and baddies. And if you go on the Breitbart website, wouldn't necessarily recommend it, listeners, so I did it for you, you have topics like big government or big Hollywood. And so the idea is that you don't just have a story about facts, about stuff that has happened. You have a story which is about liberals in big government doing really big inefficient problems, or that it's the liberals in Hollywood which are creating terrible content. And those two things, I think, are very interesting. They're the kind of the most interesting things I took from the book.
Mm. I think the other kind of thing that I found absolutely fascinating was Bannon's worldview as kind of someone who seemingly buys into the notion that there's always a great enemy for the West or for America. In the 20th century, for the most part, it was communism. And then moving into the late 20th and 21st century, you end up with Islam, radical Islam, as that other which needs to be defended against. And then again, you've also got China as a potential foe in the future. Now, I don't think this actually comes out in Devil's Bargain, but I've acquired the Michael Wolff book, Fire and Fury, and I'm going through that slightly at the moment as well. And in that, one of the first things that Bannon is said to have muttered to someone, I think it might have been Roger Ailes from Fox News, was that China is going to be the new Cold War, and at some point they're going to go, to quote him, full Nazi Germany and go hyper-nationalistic. So Bannon is very much an individual who has this us versus them mentality, given that he has this viewpoint of it's us versus the world, and only we are the righteous, and only we are the worthy who can overcome it, based on his kind of Roman Catholic background. It provides an interesting and fascinating glimpse into how you end up with the kind of policies that you've mentioned earlier, such as the refugee ban.
Yeah, the book's kind of interesting on the development of his thought, and so looks at things like the Iranian hostage crisis and 9/11 as being events that crystallised Bannon's view into that clash of civilisations that he's quite big on. It's a kind of riff on the view of John Maynard Keynes. Many believe themselves to be practical and exempt from all sorts of theoretical thought, end up being usually the slaves of some defunct economist, where he talks about people like, I think, René Guénon or something, and 20th century French occultists who think that the West is entering some sort of Kali Yuga phase, and the idea is that it's a cyclical 6,000 years.
Yeah, so just to put that, Kali Yuga, I believe, is a concept in Hinduism, where basically civilization enters a period of decline, and Bannon seems to, based on what's mentioned in Devil's Bargain, seems to believe that we are on the cusp of a Kali Yuga itself, and that Western civilization is about to go into decline unless we fight back it, unless we fight back against it. And for him, fighting back against it is fighting back against globalization, the global notion of like no borders and things like that, very much moving back to the notion of the nation state and a people within that state.
Basically, Steve Bannon is a very interesting wanker.
Yeah, it's a very apt description.
You talk about Breitbart, that kind of talks leads us onto the world of Warcraft stuff.
Yes.
So Steve Bannon, also quite opportunistic businessman as yep. well, and has tried to make his fortune with various things, one of which was World of Warcraft. Now, for those younger listeners, do you want to try and explain what World of Warcraft actually was?
It's still going.
Is it?
Yeah. So World of Warcraft, massive online fantasy, massive multiplayer online roleplay game. And the way this connects to Steve Bannon and the Donald Trump presidency is amazing. Bannon moved to, I believe it was Hong Kong, or was working in and around Hong Kong at one point, and was working with or for a company that farmed gold in World of Warcraft, which is just not a sentence I thought I'd ever say.
I can't believe you said that sentence.
But yeah, essentially, within World of Warcraft, you had companies who would pay people to just go in, collect gold online, and then sell that gold in real life for real money. There was an exchange rate and everything. It's like Bitcoin before Bitcoin was a thing. Basically, this business tanked, but the business tanked because there were an awful lot of people who were male, young, had disposable income, and spent an awful lot of time online playing games and visiting forums, who were able to organise themselves to force Blizzard to crack down on the gold farming that was happening on servers for World of Warcraft. And male, online a lot, active on forums, a lot of free time on their hands, is basically the core demographic of the alt-right. Bannon seemed to realise that these people could be tapped into for other ends as well as money-making mechanisms. What he also seemed to tap into, and I'm not sure if it's by intent or by luck, is that an awful lot of these kind of active people, or number of them, have aren't as successful as they might otherwise think they should be. They are very much are open for persuasion to fall into kind of Bannon's way of thinking on a number of issues, especially around the ideas of having those others with which you need to do combat against. And as a result of Bannon's experiences, he took all of that and threw it into Breitbart News after he took over as, I think, CEO. So in a really weird kind of way, Breitbart News and Donald Trump's presidency doesn't happen without the World of Warcraft.
Very much Cleopatra's nose version of history, isn't it? It feels like AJP Taylor saying that World War One was caused by train timetables.
Yeah.
Which I have a feeling is probably a podcast we should do, actually. Another interesting turning point, which maybe leads us to the particular kind of Trump presidency we have, is this press conference dinner in which the great and the good of New York are invited and Trump is invited. And I think Trump, the property moguls, always wanted to get into that world, so was quite flattered, I think, wanted to be invited. And Barack Obama was going to be there, and this is in the middle of the birther controversy that was going on,
of which Trump was fueling.
Obama with John Lovett, who is one of the hosts on Pod Save America and Love It or Leave It now. He works with people like Judd Apatow and does some jokes on Trump, and they're genuinely quite funny, and Obama can deliver them quite well, and Trump's basically humiliated in front of this crowd. Didn't want to show it, but definitely was.
Yeah, left very soon afterwards.
This seems to be a turning point because it was Trump realising that he's not going to be accepted in with this world. Like, he can't command that mainstream society, like the kind of the elite strand, you could say, anymore. And so instead does push him to the fringes and work with...
Yeah, it pushes him down the rabbit hole that is towards the alt-right. Again, it's one of those wonderfully weird things where it's just like, if Obama just hadn't cracked those jokes, then does Trump actually run for president? Maybe not, because an awful... from at least from what's said in Devil's Bargain, the implication is that that was one of the crystallizing moments where Trump decided, no, I'm doing this. I'm going to show them that I'm serious. about doing this.
In some ways, that feels a little bit too movie-tastic. Mm. But because Trump had talked about running in the 80s, he talked about running in 2000. What is interesting that the book posits is an interesting alternative reality, and that is Trump as a more mainstream Republican candidate. Because one of the things that Green talks about is that actually Trump's ratings among African Americans and Latino groups on The Apprentice were really high, mm-hmm. and higher than that most white presenters, I think, and most. There is a different narrative, I think, somewhere in which actually you have Trump as a businessman who is appealing to those constituencies of the Republican Party it cannot normally target.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble, maybe, as we've seen from Trump's presidency, is that he's just not particularly bright and not particularly competent, and maybe that was never going to happen.
It is an absolutely fascinating way to think that in some ways Trump had the potential to be the presidential candidate that reversed a number of the problems that the Republicans had. Well, Mitt Romney lost the 2012 election to Barack Obama, and they put out a report afterwards which basically said we need to appeal to ethnic minorities, especially Hispanics. It's not inconceivable to see a timeline where Trump doesn't quite get as deep into the hole that he gets himself into online, and doesn't follow quite so many white supremacist accounts, and as a result doesn't come down those giant golden escalators when he announced he was running for president, and then immediately accuse Mexicans of all being rapists and murderers. That one move right there probably torched any hope that he would have had of being able to reach out to minorities. But it is fascinating to think that there was, in theory, a path for him to reach out to those demographics that now it was just inconceivable.
Basically, listeners, we are in the darkest timeline. There is no escape.
Grab your go-tos if you don't have them already.
Maybe the contribution that Green says that Bannon made, and again, I think the contribution of Bannon to Trump's victory is very overstated. I think without James Comey, Trump doesn't win. But it almost seems like Bannon was the encourager of Trump's worst tendencies. Probably you saw that when Bannon was encouraging Trump to go and endorse a racist to be a senator.
There's also the fact that it was Bannon who, during the campaign, masterminded the idea of taking all of the women who had accused Bill Clinton of sexual harassment or rape and putting them on the front row of one of the debates. Now, this was basically told wasn't allowed to happen by the debate organisers because they just knew how incendiary that would be. And as a result, it didn't happen because some people saw sense and basically told Bannon that's not going to happen.
Yeah, I repeat again, Steve Bannon is a wanker. And if I have one... I enjoyed the book. I read it very quickly. It's quite well written. What I would quite like, maybe, is a little bit more condemnation of his politics, because I don't know if that's just me because I happen to be on the left, but I like to think that left or right we can agree that maybe nationalism and white supremacy isn't a great thing. And I'm sure that Joshua Green seems to have written this from the point of view of access. There's quite a lot of insight into the Trump campaign, into the Trump White House, and into Steve Bannon's views that we wouldn't have got otherwise. And unlike Michael Wolff, he hasn't torched his contacts by writing about how terrible they are. But there's a bit of I don't know how to say it better other than to say there's a bit of an objective coverage about Steve Bannon which you probably shouldn't have about someone who's got the dangerous, nasty views that he has.
Yeah, it's a bit of condemnation would be nice. I think the other thing that would be beneficial for the book, though, is a bit more of giving the other side of the story. It very much seems to be written almost as though as it's a mouthpiece for Bannon and how great Bannon is, it's going to be fascinating comparing it to the Michael Wolff Fire and Fury book, because I think we're going to get two very, very different perceptions of Bannon from both of them. And in all likelihood, the truth is probably somewhere between the two of them. Bannon's not an idiot. You don't get to be what he's achieved without by being an idiot. So it's likely he did have some say and some role in actually getting Trump to where he is at various points. But I don't feel he's the mastermind that he was initially built up to be, the puppet master. It's quite fascinating to see the myth of Steve Bannon built up and then eradicated so very, very quickly.
And I think if there is, has been a bit of a constant theme over the 18 months or so we've been doing the podcasts, it is that populist campaigning, populist governments doesn't really lead to effective governance. Mm-hmm. And that there is a very big difference between being a good campaigner, or being, one could say, an effective campaigner, and then governing effectively. And I've already mentioned the Muslim ban as being a good example of Bannon's ineffectiveness at crafting policy that works. I mean, he famously described himself as a Leninist who wants to bring down a system. Yeah. Turns out bringing down a system isn't really an effective platform for government.
Yeah, and just due to Bannon's personality as well, I mean, he crafted that Muslim ban without telling any of the agencies that would have to be responsible for enforcing it. I don't necessarily know if this came from Devil's Bargain, but there have been reports, I think, from at the time, that the head of ICE and the head of some of the travel agencies and things who were responsible for kind of seeing these people in and out of the country didn't know it was a thing until they watched it announced on TV. He did that deliberately. That wasn't an oversight. That was something he's supposed to have done deliberately to cause chaos and to try and shake the system. I mean, he caused chaos. He got a lot of people angry, and it was the people he wanted to make angry, but it didn't achieve anything.
It's the difference between being the leader of a bullshit website and being the leader of a country.
Yeah.
And they are not
anywhere near comparable.
At the end of the book, there's a brief afterword that I think must have been written... Well, I think this book was probably written as a deadline to coincide with Trump's inauguration, I would guess.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it got republished, maybe it got republished here. And there's a brief afterword on, I suppose, three reasons as to why there's chaos in the White House. And I think they still stand up pretty well, considering. So the first one is something we've talked already on the podcast, and we talked about when Trump's negotiating with North Korea, is that Trump feels like being president is about asserting dominance. We've talked quite a bit about how... Trump has a particular kind of masculinity and a zero-sum approach to politics and power, which doesn't really fit in with how you achieve stuff. And that's kind of interesting. You can't bully members of Congress to do a job, because they're not beholden to you for their position. They are beholden to their electors, for instance. Also, and this is kind of interesting, is that Trump ran against Republican mainstream, ran against Wall Street, then took up Paul Ryan's agenda.
Yep.
And actually, I think a lot of Democratic strategists were worried that Bannon's infrastructure spending might be the thing they got focused on, at which point maybe you do try and pick that, the Republicans do pick up that Rust Belt support. That hasn't happened.
No.
Now the Republicans are celebrating passing the most unpopular bill of all time, they've gone further down the insane rabbit hole. And the final one I slightly disagree with, in that it says Trump really doesn't believe in anything in particular apart from, he's kind of just a creation of his own ego, which I don't think is quite true. Because if you look, certainly, for instance, at trade, you look at what Trump has said about trade deals in the 80s, it's very similar to what he's saying about trade deals now. It's just the country's changed. In the 80s, it was Japan that he was worried about, whereas now it's China who's seen as the bugbear. So I would slightly disagree with that.
Yeah, I'd say that Trump has a kind of a core set of beliefs. I wouldn't necessarily say he has an ideology, though. And that's something that's very unusual in anybody who seeks political office of any sort. It doesn't matter how kind of low office that might be it a city councillor or you know, a parish councillor even potentially, they normally have at least some kind of core set of things they want to get done, or a core beliefs that will influence how they move things forward that can be quite wide-ranging. I don't think Trump has anything like that. I think Trump just has some beliefs which have been consistent, because they're related to things he knows and he's interested in. So because he's a businessman, he thinks he knows a lot about trade. He doesn't know a lot about trade, but he thinks he does, because trade is to do with business. And he's a very successful businessman, and therefore he must know what he's doing with it. And because Trump views everything with that as that zero-sum power play, anything that doesn't go 100% America's way, and therefore 100% Trump's way, is a failure, and, you know, is an example of America being defeated.
Mm. The best way I've almost seen a friend compared Trump to a bear that just kind of lashes out at stuff. And I think, certainly with Twitter, I'd like to do a podcast on Trump's tweets, but it feels like it's becoming increasingly clear that there is no real strategy there. It's just an old man watching television and shouting at stuff.
Yeah, from the excerpts and from what I've read of Fire and Fury by Michael Wolff, which is something we're probably going to end up going into on another podcast at some point anyway. One of the things that that Trump is described as is being either semi-literate or post-literate, depending on who you were talking to and how nice they were feeling, because he, by 6:30 in the evening, he's in bed with a McDonald's and he's watching cable news. And that's all he does a lot of the time. He doesn't read anything. He just gets everything from TV.
I suppose if he's in a post-literate society, what he should do is to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes.
It's true. You don't need to read a thing.
Or listen to it on Spotify. We're on Spotify now. That is exciting. So we'd like to do more episodes like this. If you've got a book you'd like to have us read and discuss, please send them in on Twitter, which and our Twitter handle is @NoChampagnePod. On Facebook, our page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our website is notenoughchampagne.com. My Twitter handle is paperbackrioter.
And I'm @CenterRadical.
James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And Dave Depper produced our theme tune. Plucky good times. Happy plotting.